This evening, the 2011 Proms theme of French connections takes us to ancient and distant worlds in the company of two generations of French composers who share a fondness for sensuous harmonies and deliciously evocative orchestration. We're going to hear three scores by Debussy and Ravel. After the interval, Ravel takes us to ancient Greece for his ballet Daphnis and Chloe, a choreographic symphony, he called it, filled to the brim with brilliant colours and magical harmonic touches. In some ways, it's the polar opposite of Ravel's Bolero, which ends the first half of the concert, a perfectly scored minimalist crescendo. And the concert begins with a symphonic poem by Claude Debussy that, for some commentators, is the upbeat to modern music. Prelude à l'après-midi d'un faune, the prelude to the afternoon of a faun, Debussy's response to a poem by Stéphane Mallarmé. And after it, cellist Lynn Harrell is the soloist in a concerto written for Rostropovich by French composer Henri Dutilleux, whose 95th birthday we're marking at the Proms. To some, Dutilleux has inherited the mantle of Debussy and Ravel, and in Tout un monde lointain, a whole distant world, he takes his inspiration from Baudelaire, a French poet who was a powerful influence on Mallarmé. So you can begin to hear just how well woven our French connections are this evening. And if you detect the slightest of Scottish accents, then that's hardly surprising, as this is the first of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra's Proms this season with chief conductor Donald Runicles. We'll be hearing his thoughts on Ravel's Daphnis a little later. And don't forget to take a look at the Proms website, where you'll find a programme for this evening's concert, as you can every night of the season. But first, we put ourselves into the hoofprints of Mallarmé's faun, the forest spirit that's half man, half goat, as he rests in a sun-dappled classical landscape, remembering an erotic encounter. Debussy's L'après-midi d'un faune may seem to follow the outline of the poem, yet it fashions a set of musical images and impressions that free it from the words as it envelops us in its own sensuous world. What did Mallarmé himself think of Debussy's musical reaction to his poem? Well, the poet sent a letter to the composer saying he'd just left a concert performance deeply moved, and he said that it was only at odds with his text, inasmuch as it went much further into nostalgia and into light, with finesse, with sensuality, with richness. And the letter ends, "I press your hand admiringly, Debussy. Yours, Mallarmé." The men were already friends. In fact, they used to go and listen to Gregorian chant together in one of the churches in Paris, and they were seen together at Wagner opera premieres in the city as well. Well, that applause was for the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra's guest leader, David Adams, already in his place on stage. And to conduct them in Claude Debussy's L'après-midi d'un faune, here comes chief conductor Donald Runicles, ready to cue the famous shimmering flute solo that opens a window onto another world.
Thank you.
The prelude to the afternoon of a faun. Claude Debussy's general impression of a poem, as he called it himself, a succession of scenes showing the desires and dreams of a faun in the heat of the afternoon. Perfect for a Royal Albert Hall audience that must have been wilting in the afternoon sun as they queued for this evening's performance. And it was given by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and its chief conductor, Donald Runicles. And that opening flute solo was played by principal flautist Rosemary Elliott. So the world of Debussy's Faun was taken from Stéphane Mallarmé's poem, and Mallarmé himself was powerfully influenced by another French modernist poet, 21 years his senior, Charles Baudelaire, whose writings explored life in mid-19th century Paris and the changing nature of human existence in the modern urban metropolis. In Les Fleurs du Mal, The Flowers of Evil, Baudelaire explores the transformation of beauty in the industrialized city, and it was from this collection that Henri Dutilleux drew inspiration for his cello concerto, written for Mstislav Rostropovich in the late 1960s. Dutilleux called his concerto Tout un monde lointain, a whole distant world. This evening's soloist, Lynn Harrell, knew Rostropovich well, and he obviously loves the piece as much as his old friend did.
Henri Dutilleux wrote this great work in 1970. It took him about 10 years, but he's known to be very slow in his oeuvre. It is extraordinary in its expression, in its harmony, and in the beauty of sounds. It revolutionizes what a cello can do with an orchestra. And unlike many contemporary works, one would have to say that it has a new sound to it even today, that it is so true to the nature of the cello. We are a singing instrument. We are a reflective, inward instrument. And helped by the inspiration of Baudelaire's poetry from Fleur de Mal, we have to be a forlorn lover. We have to incinerate ourselves through sexual passion in this work. And that's true to the cello's nature too. One thinks of Don Quixote by Strauss. So it's a great thrill to play this work. I do feel that it's the greatest piece for cello and orchestra since Dvorak.
Lynn Harrell, and as any cellist will tell you, that's very high praise. The concerto's title, A Whole Distant World, is taken from one of Baudelaire's Flowers of Evil. La chevelure, the head of hair in which he smells scents, spirits, seas and memories, other worlds and experiences as the black locks fall in curls to the shoulders. The line that supplies the title comes from the second verse. Languorous Asia and sweltering Africa, a whole faraway world, almost defunct, dwells in your deep aromatic forest. While other spirits glide on waves of music, mine, my love, swim in your scent. Well, there are five movements in Dutilleux's concerto, each of which is given a single word from Baudelaire as its title. The first is enigma, the second, gaze or contemplation, then comes waves, the swell of the sea, mirrors, and finally, him. And here comes conductor Donald Runicles with this evening's soloist, Lynn Harrell, to perform the cello concerto finished in 1970 by Henri Dutilleux. Tout un monde lointain, a whole distant world.
Thank you. Thank you.
hymn, the last movement of Tout un monde lointain, a whole distant world by Henri Dutilleux, the French composer who's celebrating his 95th birthday this year, and it was performed here at the BBC Proms by American cellist Lynn Harrell with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Donald Runicles. And the first thing they did at the end of that performance, after that silence had melted into the applause, was embrace one another warmly. Donald Runicles still on the podium, applauding as Lynn Harrell makes his way back to the front of the stage. And the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra brought to their feet to share the applause. That was the cello concerto proposed by Mstislav Rostropovich when he first met Dutilleux in 1961, after which they actually became great friends, and Rostropovich went on to persuade the composer to write another two pieces for him. And a movement of another Dutilleux work, Correspondance, pays homage to Rostropovich and his wife, Galina Vishnevskaya. And by the way, there's going to be more Dutilleux at the Proms because of this 95th birthday celebration. You can hear the violin concerto, L'Arbre des Songes, played by Leonidas Kavakos. And the London Symphony Orchestra and Valery Gergiev will also perform Slava's Fanfare, which is Dutilleux's birthday tribute to the great cellist who commissioned the concerto we just heard. Here's Lynn Harrell, once again, throwing his arms wide to welcome the applause from the promenaders down below, and pressing his hand to his chest as he acknowledges the warmth of his reception here. He's sitting down. I think we're going to have some more music. The Bourets from Bach's third suite for solo cello, played as an encore at his prom by cellist Lynn Harrell. No repeats, I suspect, so that he could play both movements without taking too much of our time here in the Royal Albert Hall. And Lynn's on his way home after the prom. He has a few concerts in September, he says, but he tells me what he's really looking forward to is recording the complete solo suites of Bach in Seattle in November. That's going to be filmed for DVD as well. Repeats reinstalled for that, I'm quite sure. Here he comes again onto the stage. The cello, by the way, it's not his usual Montagnana instrument, the one he's had for almost half a century, which he calls his voice. He's been on holiday before the prom, travelling in the Middle East, so he borrowed an instrument by the Austrian luthier David Techler, made in Rome in 1711, he was telling me earlier. He's had it for a few days now, and as you heard, it might be a new friendship, but it's already bearing fruit. Well, quite a few commentators feel instinctively that Dutilleux's ear for orchestration and harmony echo Maurice Ravel's. And in the second half of this evening's concert, we'll be hearing his grandest orchestral masterpiece, the ballet Daphnis and Chloe, which took 3 years of hard graft to complete. And it makes for quite a contrast with the work that ends the first half of the concert, Ravel's Bolero, written in just a few weeks in 1928. The Russian ballerina Ida Rubinstein obviously admired Ravel's skills as an orchestrator and his ear for Spanish colours, as shown in his Rhapsodie Espagnole. So Rubinstein commissioned Ravel to make transcriptions of 6 piano pieces from Isaac Albéniz's Iberia, and Ravel set to with some enthusiasm, only to find out that orchestrations had already been made by a Spanish conductor and copyright law blocked any new versions. To what extent Ravel's irritation was a part of what happened next, we can only guess. But after talking to Rubinstein, Bolero began to take shape, a Spanish dance built over a rhythmic motif on the snare drum and an obsessively repeated melody that's passed from instrument to instrument, cleverly reorchestrated to give shifting timbres and a steady crescendo over 10 minutes or so. Which may not sound like such a neat trick, but you ask anyone who composes or orchestrates music and they'll tell you what a brilliant demonstration of technical skill this actually is. Not just technical. Ask yourself why this is Ravel's most famous work by far, why its insistent, nagging rhythm and sinuously repetitive melody have seen it starring in some seriously unexpected places, from silver screen love scene to Olympic ice rink, and I suspect you'll have to acknowledge something Ravel himself seemed to find it hard to accept, that his Bolero is a stroke of genius. Well, that at least seems to have been recognised by audiences from the word go. The ballet was a sensation when it was first danced at the Paris Opera in 1928, set inside a Spanish tavern where people are drinking and dancing under a brass lamp, and as a female dancer leaps onto the table, everything becomes more animated. Ravel apparently preferred a setting with the dance taking place in the open air, in front of a factory, so that the mechanism that propels Bolero found an echo in the landscape. Well, for the mechanical analogy, we're going to have to settle for the Royal Albert Hall's magnificent organ as a backdrop for Ravel's Bolero in tonight's prom. Guest leader of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, David Adams, has just tuned them. I see the side drummers in place. And here to conduct Bolero comes the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra's chief conductor once again, Donald Runicles. The tapping of a side drum is imminent. Bolero, Maurice Ravel's mechanical music machine, described by the composer as a piece for orchestra without music. And that first roar of applause and cheer was for the snare drum player Heather Corbett in the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. I wonder if anyone's ever thought of taking the pulse of the snare drum player before the performance of Bolero and then again afterwards. It could be quite interesting. Donald Ronicles, the series conductor, bringing the wind and brass sections to their feet one at a time to acknowledge their parts in that orchestral crescendo. We should mention the principal flautist, Rosemary Elliott, again. Piccolo, played by Rosemary Locke. Principal clarinets, Jan Giro, bassoon. Lovely solo from Julian Roberts. Oboist, Stella McCracken. Core anglais, James Horan. And the two saxophonists, Carl Raven and Gareth Brady. And a slinky trombone solo as well from Simon Johnson. Sometimes Ravel didn't seem to know quite what to make of Bolero, surprised by its success in the concert hall after its original incarnation as a ballet. But after listening to the reaction of the audience, the promise here in the Royal Albert Hall this evening, well, I think we know what to make of it. Ravel's music, by the way, has been a mainstay of Proms programmes since the early days. Founder Sir Henry Wood was a Ravel enthusiast, and he conducted UK premieres of quite a few of his works, the Rhapsody Espagnol, La Valse, the left-hand piano concerto. How do I know this? From the Proms archive online, which has searchable details of every concert since 1895. It's like browsing a dictionary. Once you get in there, you could be there for hours. You'll find it from the Proms website. Well, there's more Ravel in the second half of the Prom, much more Ravel, as it's his biggest orchestral score by some margin. A complete performance of the ballet Daphnis and Chloe will be staying in the hall in the interval, and I'll be talking to the South Bank Centre's Marshall Marcus in a few minutes about some of this week's highlights. And we'll also have some poetry and jazz from the J.J. Wheeler Quintet from Saturday's Proms Plus late event. And here's a young man who's been called one of the funniest and most brilliant performance poets of his generation. That's not me saying it, I'm quoting from one of his recent reviews. This is Luke Wright, introducing himself to the audience in the Royal Albert Hall's Elgar Room on Saturday.
It's called The Ballad of Mr. and Mrs. P. Cartwright, Extreme Skiers. Hello there, what have we here? A ballad? My, what fun. I like the way they tend to go da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. Solid and predictable, like Little Harpinon. And Little Harpinon is where this ghastly tale unfolds. You know the sort of place I mean? It's got a church, it's old, where Barber, Argos, Trollop Sagas and Tipsy Jams are sold. The sort of little country place that London folk find pretty, so Kirsty helps them find a house at prices that are silly, while Phil sets out to track them down a crash pad in the city, close to the bars and restaurants that they love. It's here in Little Harpinon, the Cartwrights got all homey. Their third car was a Land Rover to tow their daughter's pony. They used to vote Conservative, but then they switched to Tony, and blow me, before you knew it, the kids had flown the nest. The Cartwrights watched them graduate, dressed in their Sunday best. Jemima's having babies now, and Rue's at RBS. Predictably, retirement came. The firm threw Peter Doo. The chairman made a lovely speech which touched them through and through. Then he and Mrs. Cartwright left to explore new avenues. Their life became as syrupy as a Richard Curtis rom-com. She'd potter in the garden while he'd test drive with his tom-tom and say to neighbours as he passed, "Great bit of kit this, you got one." Mere weeks into their reverie, Jemima came to call. "Enjoy your golden handshake, Dad, just don't spend it all. Do you know, when this place is mine, I might take down that wall, get a windmill in the garden, take the place off-grid. Sorry, Mum, what's that? The china? Think we'll just get rid. Darn, I'm late for Pilates. Will you mind the kids?" And with that, the yummy mummy went and left her parents reeling. Seconds later, Rupert entered, jabbing at the ceiling. "You want to keep an eye on this? I've got a nasty feeling there might be structural damage here, and I won't pay the bill. It's awfully tough at RBS. I only got a mill. Oh yeah, and by the way, old boy, need to see the will. Might need some of my bit now. Could we work some trip? I got some poor girl up the spuff. Need to get her fixed, but not right now. Got a dash, so maybe fax me. Oh, and here's the leaflet for that home." He gave his dad a poke. "Your heart could pack up any day, and she's prime for a stroke. Just promise you'll consider it." And with that, Rue left his folks. Peter Cartwright sighed and said, "We knew this day would come. Didn't they call it karma after what we did to Mum? Camilla, Pudding, please don't cry. Trust me, They'll get none. Behind his specs, his cruel eyes slimmed, he banged his palsied fists. Yes, darling, fetch the Bollinger, let's get really pissed. Grab that pad of Basil and Bond, let's make a shopping list. Massage tables, exercise bikes, Botox for our faces, suits for me, hats for you, a weekend at the races. Golly, this bolly folly's jolly, let's buy a few more cases. Cottage in the Hebrides, shall we get a country pub? We could hire an alcoholic chef to make the standard grub and slowly drink the profits of the place is boarded up. Let's go trekking in the Andes. Shall we get a boat? I could run for Parliament. I doubt I'll get the votes, but I hear the PR's very dear. Let's at least get a quote. So, Mr. and Mrs. P. Cartwright flash their reckless streak as branded Luton vans arrive with gadgets and antiques. Expensive hobbies were began, then abandoned in a week. The children's former bedrooms house flutes they never played, plus dusty golf clubs, dinner sets, racing bikes and lathes. You've heard of affluenza, right? Well, this was affluades. A raging, rampant visa virus they hoped was terminal, though every month their spirits sank when Pete's accountant called to cheerily reassure them that they hadn't spent it all. And every time they got depressed and tired of their endeavour, their offspring throwing them to suggest a little get-together for their lawyers, convincing them they must spend more than ever, and though they tried their utmost, their credit wouldn't taper. The Cartwrights were quite comfortable a year into their caper, until one morning Pete let out a shriek over the paper. Camilla, look, it says right here, Rue's bank is at the limit. It says it's staffed by nincompoops whose policies are gimmicks. It's going under any day. Hey, let's throw our money in it. An anxious 30 minutes passed and Pete put down the phone. The broker needed talking round. It didn't like his tone, though eventually he saw sense. Our legacy is blown. Hours later, the bank went down. The media made a fuss. Interviewing blokes like Rue just said, don't blame us. The Treasury should have bailed us out. You know, it's darn ridiculous. As repo men in cheap grey suits went from floor to floor, the Cartwrights clinked their champagne flutes and let off loud guffaws till, when their house had emptied out, they shut the kitchen door and walked through a little harping home for several voiceless hours, stopping every now and then to pick each other flowers till, when the sunset fell on them, they climbed the church's tower. And shoeless on the battlement, half lit by orange light, Peter and Camilla Cartwright stood as man and wife till, after many minutes there, they stepped into the night. But hold it, folks, don't shed your tears. This wasn't suicide. The old church tower in Harpington is 30 foot high. Those cunning spendthrift baby boomers were only paralysed. And in hospital, for decades more, the Cartwrights lay quite still, which meant that no one knew if they'd intended to be killed, though Rupert saw they winked at him when he came to play their bill.
That was poet Luke Wright in performance at the Proms Plus late event here in the Royal Albert Hall last weekend. And if you haven't come across them yet, these are new this season. They're once a week informal late events happening after the evening prom, showcasing some of the best and brightest young talents in poetry and jazz. And in a few minutes, I'll have another highlight from the occasion, a Radiohead cover played by the J.J. Wheeler Quintet. Now, you're listening to BBC Radio 3 live here at the Royal Albert Hall, where right now it's the interval of our French Connections prom, and I'm joined by Marshall Marcus, who's head of music at London's South Bank Centre. Now, Marshall, have you been enjoying unravelling our French Connections already, and the Doutier especially?
I think it's been a great first half, actually. It's that wonderful French atmospheric stuff coming, and it just kind of puts you in dreamland, I think. And the Doutier were particularly a long enough piece right in the middle of the half that actually just took a lot of us away, and then the Ravel to bring you back.
Some extraordinary atmosphere conjured by Lynn Harrell and the players as well. The way the musical lines seem to come right from the depths of the instrument and then just sort of get played out along the whole orchestra.
I think that's right, and I think also it's very interesting watching this orchestra at the moment. I think they're really enjoying their relationship with Donald Runicles as chief conductor, who's been, I think, 2 years with them. And I was talking to some of the players before the concert began, and you can just feel that actually conductor, orchestra, they get on so well.
Now, Marshall, looking ahead, there have to be, well, there are one or two, obviously, eye and ear-catching proms ahead of us this week. A couple of late-nighters look particularly interesting. We've got the Talis Scholars singing Victoria on Thursday, but Nigel Kennedy playing solo Bach. I mean, do we know what to expect?
Well, we know not to expect too much, because whatever we will expect, it will be different, but it will be great. I really think you're right to alight on the late-night proms coming up this week, because I'm just thinking it's 10 o'clock at night, the kids are in bed, dinner's over, something or other. You can really sit down and listen. And I think, you know, the incredible spread. Tomorrow evening, I think we've got Victoria, as you say. So almost half a millennium ago, and then we'll get up-to-date Bach on Saturday with Nigel playing a late night, and then I think next Wednesday there's Steve Reich.
That's right, Steve Reich, 18, in person as well.
In person, yeah. So I mean, I think, you know, Peter with the Tower Scholars, Nigel Kennedy, Steve Reich, that sounds all right for late night for me. I'll be there.
It's fantastic, isn't it? I should be listening. Now, speaking of Nigel Kennedy and thinking about hype, possibly, you know, I'm not trying to be unfair, but what about Friday? Because we've got Mahler's Resurrection Symphony from the Simon Bolivar Symphony Orchestra and Gustavo Dudamel. Well, no one who was there will forget their Proms debut, will they, in 2007?
I think that's right. It was definitely a kind of where were you that night in August 2007. I was here in the Proms that night, and it was... Well, people talk about it as one of the great proms of all time. But, of course, it was a prom in which the Venezuelans really indulged in that kind of Latin passion, dynamism, enthusiasm, joy, twirling those jackets around. And, of course, you know, we've got Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, a great piece that begins with the death of the hero. And they can't do that thing again. And so I really think the interesting thing this coming week, this will be the interesting prom to see on Friday, how do they now, these kids who are in their late 20s, it's no longer a youth orchestra.
They've changed, haven't they?
Yes, they've now got the name, the Simon Bolivar Symphony Orchestra. Yeah. And I heard them doing Mahler earlier in the year, a different symphony, Mahler 7, and I think we're going to have a really interesting prom. And I would definitely say tune into that one, because I think you might be watching one of the great orchestras making one of the great transformations of their career.
This is an orchestra in development, isn't it? Do we get a feeling yet for how they're changing and whether it's actually feeding back into El Sistema back at home in Venezuela?
Well, I think there are two things there. One, they certainly are transforming. And, you know, they're entering into a kind of maturing period. And the wonderful thing about it is they're on a frontier. Nobody's been there before. No orchestra that was formed in quite this way is around, or actually ever has been around. So all these kids who actually by now have probably been playing together for 15 years as an orchestra, think about that, 15 years with hardly a change in the orchestra, starting from scratch. And I think now you can just see they've learnt and they've earned that great technical side. And I think now we're going to see a kind of maturing period. This could be the
concert. That feeling of family as well when you've grown up and developed like that, which is extraordinary. And by the way, well, that's Friday's prom, the Resurrection Symphony. Good luck if you don't yet have tickets. You can still join the queue, though, for promming on the night. And someone who knows all about that is Julia Robinson, who's head of front of house at the Royal Albert Hall.
Well, the proms is great because it's very much about having hundreds of tickets accessible on the day for people who just want to turn up and enjoy some fabulous music in a great venue. So there is a queuing system outside for people who want to come along on the day, and then there are other people in queues who've already got season tickets. And so prospective audience members can just come along, join a queue, and the chances are that they'll get in. Obviously, really popular proms, they need to arrive a little bit earlier. It's the last night of the proms that really attracts the early crowd, so there will be some stalwarts who will camp out overnight. But for the rest of the season, you're probably looking at about 7 o'clock in the morning for somebody who's really intent on getting to the front and being as close to the orchestra and to the action as they can. It's a great way to make a sort of last-minute decision on a day to go and see one of the world's top orchestras pitch up at the Royal Albert Hall, pay £5, go in, potentially have one of the best views in the whole auditorium. It's amazing.
Oh, it certainly is. And you do, from various places in the hall, if you're promming, get some of the best views, Marshall. I mean, you know this, don't you, personally?
Well, yes. I mean, years ago, there was a lot of promming downstairs. Now I tend, if I'm going to prom, to go upstairs, which I think is one of the great secrets of London. So here I am splashing it out on to the nation. But I think to go up there, where you can stand looking over, you can lie on the floor, there are even a few chairs at the back, and the sound is great up there.
It can be tremendous, can't it? And you can find yourself sort of sharing elbow room with some of the offstage bands and brass and things like that,
well,
depending which prom you go.
That's kind of added extra, yes.
Now, we've mentioned the Venezuelans. We've got to talk about our own National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain on Saturday. It's still an extraordinary institution, isn't it?
It is, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's so interesting to look at the difference in programme there. I mean, we've got Mahler II, one of these great war horses with the Venezuelans. Then the next night, the National Youth Orchestra pitching up our great young players' orchestra. And what are they doing? Concerto for Turntable with DJ Switch by Gabriel Prokofiev. And, you know, I just think that that shows the incredible flair and enthusiasm that orchestra's got these days, and with Sarah Alexander, their director, who's really taken them to all sorts of places. And I just think Vladimir Yurovsky, one of the great conductors of all time, Prokofiev's grandson composing, that's going to be a great night. And then Ben Grosvenor thrown in, just for a few more young people.
And have you got any clue what to expect with the Concerto for Turntable? Have you heard any snippets?
I haven't heard any snippets of this one. I actually did say to Gabriel, I had a chat with him and said, well, come on, what have you got in store for us? And he said, well, the great thing about this piece is that I'd already worked on it with DJ. And he said, but the idea of them being told, by the way, would you like to enlarge it for 160 players? Boy, he said yes. So I think we're going to get a lot of excitement on that one.
And one thing you can always depend on with the National Youth Orchestra Prom every year is that extraordinary enthusiasm. You'll get a very big orchestra. They pack as many people as is physically possible onto the stage to give everybody an opportunity. Something I remember very well, actually. I played in my first prom in the National Youth Orchestra under a rather younger Ricardo Chailly. I won't tell you how long ago, but the enthusiasm that you get and the attention and the focus from these young players is extraordinary, isn't it?
You better not tell me how long ago that was, because I will then retort with my concert with the NYO in the 60s, I think it was. Anyway, with Pierre Boulez, no less. No, I mean, this is a great thing. The tradition of this orchestra, you know, has really carried on. And I just love watching them these days because they're trying so many different things. And so what you've got is this tremendous marriage, on the one hand, of enthusiasm absolutely on the button of trying the new things, together with great technique. Boy, they can play.
Absolutely they can. Well, Marshall Marcus, thank you very much indeed for joining me live here in the Royal Albert Hall, leaning over the front of the box and telling us about some of the things you're looking forward to this week. We're preparing for the second half of this evening's prom, Ravel's complete ballet, Daphnis and Chloe, which I know a lot of people in the hall have been waiting for this evening. And first, as promised, our second highlight from the most recent Proms Plus late event featuring the J.J. Wheeler Quintet. They've been picking up plaudits this year as one of the hottest UK jazz acts around. After Saturday night's prom, they gave the audience in the Elgar Room their own arrangement of a song by Radiohead. Thank you. The J.J. Wheeler Quintet's version of Radiohead's Everything in Its Right Place, recorded live at the Elgar Room here in the Royal Albert Hall last Saturday evening in one of our informal BBC Radio 3 Proms Plus late events. If you'd like to go along, the next one's in the same place, the Elgar Room, after this Friday's prom. Gustavo Dudamel and the Simon Bolivar Symphony Orchestra are playing Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, just in case you needed reminding. This is BBC Radio 3. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the BBC Proms for the second part of this evening's concert. And for the sake of the music, I'm going to ask you to imagine this great hall somewhat transformed. Banish the organ, hide the prommers, draw down a screen to cover the Edinburgh Festival Chorus, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and Chief Conductor Donald Runicles, because we're transported to ancient Greece. It's a bright spring afternoon. We're in a meadow at the edge of a sacred wood with hills in the distance and sheep grazing. There's a grotto to the right with carved images of three nymphs and a large rock that has a vague resemblance to the god Pan. And we're about to witness the romance between Daphnis and Chloe, a goatherd and a shepherdess. It's Maurice Ravel's biggest score, a magnificent celebration of his skill as a master orchestrator. And conductor Donald Runicles rates Daphnis and Chloe pretty highly.
I don't think there's a finer work for orchestra. In terms of the orchestra being played, the way a Rachmaninoff or a Chopin plays the piano or writes for the piano, I don't really think there's a finer orchestral work which is better written for the orchestra in all its facets, in all its colours, all its nuances, from the highest piccolo to the deepest bass clarinet, the variety of percussion instruments, the exquisite use of harmonics in the strings. And while it's supremely technical in that he obviously had the supreme knowledge of what an orchestra is capable of and what an instrument is capable of, you don't have to know any of that as a listener. All it is all of a sudden it's like a portal into a fairyland, this mythical story. You feel you're brought into a completely different world. I think another aspect of this work, specifically the Daphnis, is there is a very palpable feeling of or a sense of foreground and background. There's a three-dimensional nature to this score, which really draws pictures in your imagination. It's very clear what foreground is. It's very clear what the backdrop is. And he does that purely orally. I personally think it is his masterpiece. And I think it's if there's one piece I would always have open on my piano or on a music stand in a music room, it would be this. It would be just turned to a page. It's a Bible in that sense.
Donald Runicles, and here's the story behind the ballet. In the first part, shepherds and shepherdesses bring their gifts to the Temple of Pan, and we meet the lovers, Daphnis and Chloe. The other shepherdesses flirt with Daphnis. Chloe is drawn into a dance with the youths, and the cowherd Dorcan and Daphnis compete for a kiss from her. No contest. The lovers are reunited before Chloe's swept away. Another shepherdess tries to seduce Daphnis, but as she runs off, fanfares herald the attack of pirates. They abduct Chloe, and Daphnis is left cursing the temple's nymphs who couldn't protect her. They come to life and take him to pray to Pan. In the second part of Ravel's ballet, offstage voices and distant trumpets welcome us to the pirates' camp. They force Chloe to dance, and she's saved from the attentions of the pirate chief only when satyrs appear in the silhouette of Pan himself. The pirates flee in terror. And part three of the ballet opens with Ravel's famous Sunrise and Dawn chorus. Daphnis is reunited with Chloe, and an old shepherd explains that if Pan rescued her, it's because he's remembering the nymph Syrinx, who he loved and lost. So Daphnis and Chloe mime the tale of Pan and Syrinx, giving thanks to Pan before general celebrations. So arrayed in front of us is a much enlarged BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. Behind them, members of the Edinburgh Festival Chorus. Guest leader David Adams is in place, and here comes Chief Conductor Donald Runicles for this prompt performance of Ravel's complete ballet score, Daphnis and Chloe.
Thank you. Thank you.
A final explosion of joy. The general dance that ends Maurice Ravel's ballet Daphnis and Chloe, with the lovers reunited after Pan's intervention with the pirates, and brought to a close with the most enormous scything gesture of the battle from conductor Donald Ronicles, who's just shaking the hand of all the section principals he can reach in the strings. He's looking out into the lights at the rest of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. As he was telling us beforehand, he reckons this is just about the finest work for orchestra he knows, a score he cheerfully heaped to hand as a bible of orchestration. And he was conducting the Edinburgh Festival Chorus, Chorus Master Christopher Bell, and the impressive forces of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra with their guest leader tonight, David Adams. Chorus Masters, come onto the stage this time with Donald Ronicles, bringing the Edinburgh Festival Chorus to their feet. Christopher Bell bowing low to the promenaders, patted on the back by Donald Ronicles, and he is singling out one or two musicians from the orchestra, and I have to name her a third time this evening, don't I? Principal flautist Rosemary Elliott. And he's going round the rest of the winds, picking them out one at a time. There's more Ravel we can look forward to at the proms this season. He's one of the key French connections we have. Scheherazade with mezzo Susan Graham on the 24th of August. That's with Colin Davis and the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra. There's also Ravel's La Valse, the other experiment testing a dance form to destruction. Viennese corollary to Bolero. That's in the last week of the proms with the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Charles Dutoit on the 8th of September. Horn section getting their own cheers. The trumpets now, and the rest of the brass. Well, meanwhile, our Scottish friends aren't heading north just yet. Their second proms tomorrow evening. Robin Holloway's Fifth Concerto for Orchestra, Strauss's Four Last Songs, and Brahms's Second Symphony tomorrow evening from 7. But here in the Royal Albert Hall, we've just experienced the most luxurious and best orchestrated French invasion imaginable. I hope you enjoyed the French Connections as much as we did in the hall. A happy 95th birthday to Henri Dutilleux from all of us here. Bonne nuit. And back in Broadcasting House, here's Jonathan Swain.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Andrew McGregor there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on good old steam radio as opposed to online this coming Sunday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3, starting at 2 o'clock. Well, after the vocal shouts of Bacchic frenzy at the end of Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe, choral music of a very different kind in tomorrow night's late prom. It's a celebration of the great Spanish Renaissance composer Tomás Luis de Victoria, marking the 400th anniversary of his death. At the heart of the concert is Victoria's glorious Requiem, composed in 1603 for the funeral rites of the sister of Philip II of Spain. And you can also hear Victoria's lamentations for Good Friday. The singers are Peter Phillips, famous Talis scholars, the Berlin Philharmonic of Vocal Ensembles, they were once called. And that's tomorrow night's late prom live here on BBC Radio 3, starting at 10 p.m.
The BBC Proms, a festival of extraordinary musical experiences.
Four years ago, they made a sensational proms debut. Now the members of Venezuela's Simón Bolívar Symphony Orchestra return to the 2011 BBC Proms with their inspirational conductor, Gustavo Dudamel. On the programme, live from the Royal Albert Hall, one work, Mahler's spectacular Second Symphony, The Resurrection. Dudamel conducts Mahler at the BBC Proms, live on Friday night at 7:30. On BBC Radio 3.
Back to this Wednesday night, just gone 10 o'clock. And now our feature. Christopher Cook tells the story of the only tree to stand in the grounds of the Buchenwald concentration camp, Goethe's oak.
Goethe has been very often
in Buchenwald.
In Buchenwald.
This is the story of a small town in Germany, of a concentration camp on a hill nearby, and an oak tree. Weimar is the town where Goethe and Schiller and their contemporaries wrote a new kind of German identity at the start of the 19th century. Buchenwald, the camp where the Nazis murdered 56,000 men, women and children, and the tree, the only tree that the SS allowed to stand in the middle of their camp, that's Goethe's oak.
An unusual oak, almost a cross, with rusted hooks which carried people like acorns in full bloom. The oak is ashamed today that it grows from the same ground as the power of the spirit and the arrogance of the henchmen.
Did you hear the story that says something about a oak, a Goethe's oak somewhere?
Oh, of course.
Well, the legend is that Goethe supposedly wrote to somebody that as long as this oak stands, Germany will stand.
By the time we arrived in the camp, the Goethe oak was no longer living. It was a memento of a remote past.
Sitting under this oak, Goethe is supposed to have written the poem Über allen Wipfeln des Ruhe.
That is that verse, Über alle
Wipfeln des Ruhe, is one of the most...
Über allen Wipfeln ist Ruhe. In allen Wipfeln spürest du
Over all the peaks, there's peace. In all these trees, you feel no breath of breeze. The woodland birds, their sounds have ceased. Hush, for soon you'll be yourself at peace.
Goethe's famous poem is Wanderer's Nachtlied, the Wanderer's Night Song. Very often, very, very often, we thought of that poem. Not only Goethe, but we discussed Goethe, Schiller, German music. We hadn't lost our respect for the German past, but it was always weighed down by the dreariness of the present.
This is platform number 3 at Weimar Railway Station. On this and the other platforms on this neat, tidy station, from 1938, the other Germany dismounted from trains and was taken away to a new camp that had been built up in the woods outside Weimar.
The train halted briefly in a station. Somewhere a bell was ringing, and from a distance a voice could be heard calling, "Ja, hier Weimar!" Sirens wailed through the empty streets. I could see a strange procession winding its way through one of the turnings. Armed children, marching in black uniforms. They must have been about 14 or 15 years old. They were singing a song as chill as the wind howling about the streets. Through the iron grill of the window of the truck, I watched this fearful march past. Curious eyes peered from the windows of houses near to the station. I noticed a woman clutching a baby in her arms. The train jerked on.
Communists, social democrats, Christians who had fallen foul of the Nazi regime. There were also quite a number of Jews, more than is often realised, even at that time. And the Nazis had carried out this Werkschei Reich campaign, and in the course of that they'd arrested quite a number of people that they didn't like for various reasons, including so-called vagrants. There were also those who had been in prisons, and rather than be released into the community, they were then brought to Buchenwald. So it was a motley community, but a lot of them certainly were political prisoners in those early days.
Oh, Buchenwald, ich kann dich nicht vergessen, weil du mein Schicksal bist.
The concentration camps had this, at least in the 30s, this circulating population who were treated for their politics, who were treated for their alcoholism, and who would then be released into the society as cured, is something that is part and parcel of the ideology behind Buchenwald.
Sandra Gilman.
Isolation is part of cure. Isolation, of course, is also part of making these camps relatively invisible.
The prisoners would have been driven off the platform down the steps into this tunnel that runs underneath the whole station. And there, from 1938 too, they would be joined by another group of prisoners, because 1938 was the year of the pogroms against the Jewish Germans. It was the year of Kristallnacht.
But starting in the 30s, the number of deaths in these camps increases exponentially over time.
As they reached the end of this tunnel under the platforms, they would have seen before them one of the most perfect and one of the most beautiful of all German small towns. A town that was home to Goethe, home to Schiller, to the great humanist tradition at the end of the 17th and 18th century.
Prisoners who would arrive at the train station would not go through the city. Therefore, some people say, well, we did not notice. Might be true. We have also a report of one man who said, don't believe these arguments. We, as a school class, were forced by our teacher to go over to the train station as a whole collection of prisoners arrived, and our teacher wanted to show us how they look like and even support us in throwing stones at them. The key question is not knowledge, but feeling responsibility. If you don't feel responsible, you would not listen to information which might disturb you.
Ach, ich bin des Treibens müde.
Many of the prisoners from Buchenwald, on work detail here in Weimar, or marched up the steep hill to the camp beyond it, would have known that this was Goethe's town. But Goethe's house here in the centre was not for them. Verbrecher, criminals, socialists, communists and Jews, enemies of the Nazi state. Not for the first time, Goethe had been borrowed by those in power for their own ideological purposes.
Everything inside is original, including the colours of the walls. That's why, of course, we always tell people not to lean up against the walls or don't sit on the furniture. But it's just such a phenomenon to have the dining room table, the chairs, everything that he personally chose for this house. And he lived here for 40 years, having moved in here in 1792 and dying in 1832 in his 83rd year. It's just permeated with his spirit and his taste.
The house is anything but triumphant. It's admirably modest for a man who was the greatest German writer of the age, a notable scientist too. Here, Goethe, with the dramatist Schiller and others, consciously set out to create a German humanism that would counter the new radical politics of the French Revolution. Helmut Lehmann is the president of the Weimar Classic Stiftung.
Goethe gave them a new language. You have to see that. It was a new German language the classics gave to the German-speaking cultures. And it was not a nation. It was a nation only in a sense of culture, not in a sense of state.
We don't have a political unity. We are not as industrialized as Britain. We don't have the cultural nous of the French even now.
Dr. Laura Martin is senior lecturer in comparative literature at the University of Glasgow.
But we're becoming the great scientist. We've written all the music. We've done the deepest philosophy. We're the deep ones. I think that's the sense that the Germans have at that time.
There is a very typical color in the German culture, but all these protagonists of the classical period were completely aware what is going on culturally in France, in England, in Italy. Compare this situation with a situation where culture is something to make a borderline. I do not see that he could be the godfather of a special German way.
If Goethe stood aloof from the notion that the Germans were different, special even, where and when does that idea take root?
This argument of the Sonderweg, that certainly is there in the middle of the 19th century, that Germans themselves are saying, we don't have political power, but we do have cultural power, and that can console us. So by the end of the 19th century, and certainly at the beginning of the 20th century, Goethe stands for German poetry, German letters, and he stands for humaneness and humanity as the thing that Germans do. And this seems quite odd because they mix this in with German militarism, which is a very, very different thing.
Weimar and the region of Thuringia had developed a taste for firm political authority before the Nazi Party hijacked the German Republic in 1933. Local Nazis, led by Wilhelm Frick, had already joined a coalition government in Thuringia in 1929. Adolf Hitler visited the town on more than 40 separate occasions. Yet this is still Goethe's town, the cradle of a German identity, even if that identity was constantly shifting. It had lent its name to the Constitution of the German Republic that came into being after the defeat of the First World War. It was home to the German National Theatre and an important place for the discerning cultural tourist.
Weim had been a touristic place even before, thanks to Goethe and Schiller, where retired people would love to live and enjoy theatre and so on.
Daniel Gader is head of the education department at the Buchenwald Memorial Site.
That explains also why anti-modernist movements, anti-Semitic people, anti-democrats would gather here in Weimar. So traditions of against this new republican and democratic system would be pretty strong in Weimar. The Nazi youth movement, Hitlerjugend, was established here. In terms of voting, there were more than 50% voting for the Nazi party.
The Nazis had a very big interest in the classic literature, but they selected in an extreme way. So you had the Faust is the German individual, interpreted in a sense of a man of acting without moral barriers. That is one side of the Faust concept, but only one.
They were easier with Schiller because Schiller was regarded as kind of heroic, very dramatic poet. He was seen as a revolutionary, but as a national revolutionary initially, which Goethe wasn't.
Bill Niven, professor of contemporary German history at Nottingham University.
On the other hand, of course, the Nazis also had some problems with Schiller, especially in 1941, I think, Hitler decided to ban performances of William Tell because William Tell's murder of Gessler was seen as encouraging people to tyrannicide, which is not really what you wanted in 1941. Goethe was too much of a world citizen, and he was perhaps too classical too for the Nazis, I think.
But if Goethe was a classicist, he was also a fellow traveller with romanticism, with gothic ballads like Der Erlkönig, where a father loses his son on a dark night to a honey-tongued demon.
Who rides so boldly through night and wind? Goethe is part of a romantic memorialization of the forest as places of testing, as places of beauty. The brothers Grimm tell the stories, of course, of Hänsel and Gretel. Forests are those spaces where real Germany, scary Germany sometimes, right? The Earl King, scary Germany, but where danger is overcome. Romantic forests are places of testing.
Goethe says whoever walks his whole life under serious or earnest oak trees would have to become a different kind of person than somebody who every day walks under airy birch trees. What is that about? He goes on to say that he finds that each country, each folk, each people has chosen in the ancient times, chosen their place to live by having some sort of unity with the natural setting that they're in. So he sees a kind of a back and forth about humans construct the natural environment. The natural environment also, very importantly, constructs the human being. You're a different person if you walk under serious, earnest oak trees. The oak tree is very important in a lot of mythologies, including Teutonic mythology, but also goes back to classical times. It's strong, it's mighty, it also tends to attract the lightning bolts.
On the Ettersberg, there stood a large oak tree, a Großer Eiche, a fat oak. Here, said the legend, sat Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, but he didn't. There's no evidence that he lingered under this tree with his inspiration, Charlotte von Stein, and besides, the tree that sheltered them was a beech. Nevertheless, Goethe's oak became a must-see for literary tourists to Weimar from the middle of the 19th century. The Nazis, too, loved oak trees. They added oak leaves to Germany's highest military award, the Iron Cross, and Hitler, it said, regularly planted young oaks, one on the German frontier on the eve of the Second World War. 2 years before, what we might think of as a dark version of Weimar was taking shape amongst the oaks and the beech trees, amongst the Eichen and die Buchen on the slopes of the Ettersberg. A school to train the SS, a concentration camp for criminals and political prisoners, to be called Konzentrationslager Ettersberg. Bill Niven.
Because Ettersberg's associated with Goethe and Charlotte von Stein, particularly the word Ettersberg, the National Socialist Cultural Community in Weimar said it would be inappropriate to name a concentration camp after a place that was so associated with Goethe. It was decided to call it Buchenwald.
That is very typical for the German situation in the 30s. There is something which is of high value and we have to protect it against everybody, but we cannot use it. Humanity is something for literature and nothing for the political reality.
When they succeeded in getting enough of an area for the camp, they brought in prisoners from Sachsenhausen, which already existed, and the prisoners were asked to chop these trees down. So one of the most horrible experiences for them was arriving and being told to go about this physical labour of chopping down enormous numbers of trees. And the mud and the dirt and the filth, it's a pretty awful experience. Prisoners were asked not to touch the oak. That was to be protected. It was sacrosanct.
The trees on the crest of the Ettersberg dripped with wet and stretched up motionlessly into the silence that wrapped the hill and separated it from the surrounding landscape. Leaves washed out and exhausted by the winter were decaying on the ground in a gleam of moisture. Signs placed between the trees seemed to be threatening it. Area headquarters. Concentration camp Buchenwald. Danger. Keep out. Trespassers will be shot without warning.
High above Weimar is the former royal hunting lodge, Schloss Ettersberg, an elegant 18th-century cream-painted building where Goethe's patron, Duke Karl August, would entertain the literary talent that he and his mother had drawn to Weimar. Goethe and the poet Wieland and Schiller too. In front of the castle, leading along the ridge of the Ettersberg, they've cut a Zeitschneiser, literally a cut in time. You begin to realise that the history that you thought you were tracing is not one, but several histories, and that they rarely weave themselves together into a perfect pattern.
These poles represent the grave sites of victims of Special Camp Number 2.
This is the camp that was created by the Soviet authorities after 45.
Exactly, yes.
Walking this twisting time way with me is Becky Reitz. She works in the education department of the Buchenwald Memorial Site.
They were trying to imprison former Nazi offenders in the camp, but there was no real court proceedings that went along with that. Basically, it would be enough if somebody just pointed someone out and said he was active in the Nazi party. That would be reason for them to be imprisoned in the internment camp. They could find someone's name on a document without looking further into it, and that would also be justification for them to be imprisoned in the internment camp.
Before we've even reached the main site at Buchenwald, the history that we thought we knew has changed its story. A Nazi concentration camp becomes an outpost of the Gulag.
There are about 28,000 imprisoned over the period of 4 years, and about 7,000 of those died, about 25%.
Were they also murdered in the same way that the Nazis had murdered prisoners?
No, there was no execution, there was no torture, there was no forced labour. It was just very, very bad conditions. This all happened between 1945 and 1949.
When did they want to, as it were, reclaim this bit of history?
This part of the memorial site was put in after 1989, after the reunification of Germany. They knew just from prisoners in the camp and just various witnesses that people had been buried in this area or even just thrown in this area. And each of the poles represents a place where they found remains of somebody.
As you come out of the woods to a huge marshalling yards here, there's a large rock set down on the edge on which there is stenciled a particular image. It's of a cattle truck, and behind it, bars of a jail, of a prison, and beyond that, the blue of a blue sky. And then you look away from that image, and behind you see the woods stretching away, the wild spring flowers, white and yellow, and beyond the new greening trees. And it's the incongruity of nature renewing itself with a sense of death that's encapsulated in that little stencil on the rock.
They started building a railway from the main train station in Weimar up to Buchenwald, and they started building that in 1943. They were originally given only 6 months to build this 4-kilometer tract of railway line. It ended up taking them about a year to build this, and the railway was first used end of 1943, beginning of 1944. And where we're standing right now are the remains of this railway line.
They went from Weimar town, the railway station where we began our journey, right the way up here to the camp.
Because the numbers were increasing, the sheer volume of prisoners was overwhelming. Between January and April of 1945 alone, there were 5,000 prisoners arriving to the camp on a daily basis as camps were being evacuated in the east. So it was absolutely necessary to have this railway line. Not to mention there was a giant armament factory that was constructed here. They needed the railway line to transport goods and stuff up here.
On the station platform, illuminated by the searchlights, a long line of SS is waiting. They're motionless as statues, their faces concealed by the shadow of their helmets, which gleam beneath the electric lights. They're holding dogs on leashes. They know that their masters are going to let them charge at these shadows scheduled to emerge from the closed, silent cars. But the SS are motionless as statues. Time passes. The dogs stop barking and lie down at the feet of the SS, growling, their backs bristling. Behind them, in the sheet of light from the searchlights, the tall trees tremble beneath the snow. Somewhere a curt order breaks the silence, and from all directions the noise of whistles rends the air. With one mechanical movement, the row of SS approaches the car. The SS begin to howl as well. The eternal cry, los, 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 the well-polished, ritual-like mechanism repeated 1,000 times, strikes one immediately. Its doctored Wagnerian aspect.
Becky, we've arrived at Buchenwald, Buchenwald in the 21st century. There's a paved road that leads right in. What's the road called?
This road is called the Karachovic, a Spanish word, and in Spanish it means damnation or awful. It's used as an exclamation, but German takes the colloquialism of the Spanish word and it means a very fast speed. And this was the main road going into the camp. The SS officers used to force the prisoners to run. And the SS officers would stand on either sides of the road. They would beat them with sticks. They would set attack dogs upon them. Sometimes members of the Hitler Youth Group would be invited to come up here. They would spit on the prisoners, yell racial slurs. And this was all a process of breaking them into the camp, so to speak.
And the entrance of the camp would be beyond, just where we can see over there, where the first wire is?
The main gate lays right ahead.
It was pitch dark, and I don't think that there was any starlight or any moonlight at the time.
One young man imprisoned in Buchenwald in the 1940s was Reidar Dittmann, a member of the Norwegian resistance who the SS hoped to re-educate into their version of being an Aryan.
It was very bleak, very wintry. As we finally got our clothing on, we got into our barrack, which was lit up by a very dim blue light. Otherwise, the entire camp laid there in deep darkness, looking more like a large cemetery than any other place.
I've walked up from the railway past the SS barracks, and we've now arrived at the entrance of the camp itself, and I'm joined by Daniel Gaeder, who's in charge of education here at Buchenwald. Daniel, the prisoners would have not so much marched as been driven along the journey I've made, and what would have happened when they got to this gate?
Even before they would reach the gate, they would be told very brutally that they have nothing good to expect. They would receive a number, a coloured triangle for their clothes, marking them as political, Jewish or whatever. And from the very first moment, they would also experience that prisoners would also deal with them in a harsh way. So they should not expect solidarity. So the main gate was a borderline between the world outside and inside, but not as a clear cut between these two worlds, because the majority of the prisoners had to work outside of the camp, in a quarry or in factories during the wartime, so they kept being visible for the surrounding people.
The thing that strikes you standing outside the gate is how modest the building is. And although to the right you can see the familiar concrete posts looking like question marks with the barbed wire and with the lights on it, there's something rather almost domestic. It isn't a great kind of imposing entrance to a camp, is it?
Yeah, it's in the middle of a forest. There's no great square in front of this main gate, so you're somehow bumping into it. The message is clear. You have a clock on top and everything has to be done in time. The left wing of the main gate is a prison, in the camp saying that if there's anything that is not liked by the SS, you can be arrested for that, tortured and even killed.
It doesn't, as in so many of the other camps, say so you can read Arbeit macht frei.
It's a different text here. It says, jedem das seine in German, each for his own in English. A quotation from the Roman law, which positively should say, enjoy your life, enjoy your property, and everyone shall have that chance. Over here it was meant in this very cynical way, what you suffer here is what you deserve. By where you're born, Jewish or became a communist, whatever.
Reveille started at 5 o'clock in the morning. 5:30 we would go to the kitchen area to pick up the food for the day, which consisted of rutabaga soup and dark bread and a pat of margarine. That was for the entire day. Then for the prisoners at large, and we were not prisoners at large, we were kept in a separate compound. They would march to the roll call area and be counted, and this sometimes was a very trying activity that might end up very disastrously. There were also occasionally at the roll call, there were hangings, other brutalities happening, but we were not part of that because we were saved as future potential SS members.
Nothing visible is left, because the places where the barracks stood at that time are just marked with black stones. And half of the former campsite, further down, is overgrown with trees.
From the roll call area, the roads extended down into the camp in a sort of a fan-like way. The road to the right went into the administrative area. On the right side was also the crematorium. A little bit farther down from the crematorium was the kitchen area, and in front of that area rose the Goethe Oak. I always heard the phrase, "Hier ruhte Goethe auf seine Wanderungen in diesem Walde." Here Goethe rested on his wanderings in this forest. You could look out over the valley below. Must in its days have harbored a great many birds. We never heard any bird at all except once in the early spring of 1944. I can remember hearing the cuckoo.
The farmers from the next village, less than 2 miles away, would walk there and work there, and one of the survivors, Jorge Sempun from Spain, described like he would walk on a Sunday, sometimes down there, alongside of the fence and see farmers on the other side taking their Sunday walk.
No one has written so thoughtfully about Buchenwald than Jorge Semprún. A communist exile from Franco-Spain, Semprún joined the Maquis, was arrested by the Gestapo in 1943 and sent to Buchenwald.
A Sunday. At the end of the long, snow-covered avenue stood the monumental gates of the camp, surmounted by the watchtower. I'm walking in the sun. I feel a sort of dizziness in the pale sunlight of this winter dream. It's not disturbing. It's not even unpleasant. It is simply that there is no longer any criterion for reality. Goethe might appear at the end of the avenue with his faithful friend, Eckermann. Oh, wasn't this their favourite walk? Goethe and Eckermann on the avenue bordered with granite columns crowned by heraldic eagles. Today, Eckermann might write later, despite the cold, Goethe expressed a wish to walk on the Ettersberg. Saying to me, the observation of nature in winter will surely provide us a subject for conversation. Without further delay, I ordered the sleigh, smothered in a mountain of firs, up the Ettersberg, that fine hill, unfortunately so spoiled by the building of a corrective labour camp, in which criminals of several nationalities are confined.
We were all university students in our group. There were 349 of us. We lost 25, by the way, of those. But we had many literary discussions. We tried to stay intellectually alive. Certainly, Goethe was a topic that we discussed very frequently.
I stand there, motionless in the cold sunlight of this December.